keynote speaker today, 2004 World Champion of Public Speaking, Dr. Randy Harvey.
So one of the things we're going to do today is Gary's going to play the World Championship speech from 2004. Many of you have seen it. But one of the things I'd like to do as we go through this training, I'm going to teach you a number of techniques over the next 2 hours or so, however long it is. I want you to watch the speech and enjoy it, because when you see it at the end of my presentation, because I'll show it again, you'll know what's happening inside of it, and you'll understand why it works. You'll understand when I'm talking about, I'm going to teach you about perambulation, tightening the spring and releasing it with humor. I'm going to teach you about the alabaster box. I'm going to teach you about scream constructs. And you'll see all of those things. Well, the first time you watch it, they will be invisible to you. But when you watch it after I've taught them to you, you'll know exactly what's going on and why it works.
Speaker number 7, Randy Harvey. Lessons from Fat Dad. Lessons from Fat Dad, Randy Harvey.
When I was 7, we drove to my cousin's for dinner and to show off Fat Dad's new car, a 1960 Ford Fairlane. I fell asleep in the back seat, and my folks left me sleeping as they went on up to the house. When I woke up, I stumbled out of the car and headed for the porch. I was surrounded by a pack of black and tan hunting hounds. My heart jumped, and then so did I, first to the trunk and then to the roof of his new car. Mr. Contest Chair, fellow Toastmasters and guests, I was frozen like a treed raccoon. I was bawling and screaming. The hounds were circling and howling. An ugly one-eyed dog clawed and scratched its way onto the trunk, its yellow teeth snapping and foaming. I was standing in water. It was mine. His claws screeched and slipped on the glass when I heard, "Son," and I dove at the voice to be caught in Fat Dad's arms. Safety was a flannel shirt that smelled of cherry tobacco and a thunderous bellow that scattered hounds like cottonseed on the wind. The next morning, Fat Dad was buffing the scratches out of his new car. I said, "Fat Dad, I'm sorry you had to rescue me." He scooped me up in his big arms, said, "Son, in life, sometimes you're the catcher. Sometimes you're the caught. When you love somebody, their trouble is your trouble." Fat Dad was my daddy. And that loving nickname, Fat Dad, has been handed down through 4 generations to the men in my family. When I was 16, Fat Dad bought me a 1963 Volkswagen Beetle. Wide tires, chrome wheels. I was driving it one sunny afternoon, listening to Simon and Garfunkel on the 8-track. "Cecilia, you're breaking my heart." Humongous horsefly shot through the window, in my mouth and down my throat. It came back up, lodged in my right nostril. What would you do with a horsefly buzzing in your nose, taking bites the size of Texas? I steered with my knees, tried to fire that bug out of my nose. The car shot to the left, then it catapulted back to the right. Chopped down Morrison's fence, sailing across their yard, right at Mossberger's fountain, where Mary Poppins stood, holding her umbrella, pouring water from a can. I hit that fountain so hard, I launched it like Sputnik. Mary Poppins hovered briefly. then went down faster than a spoonful of sugar.
Well, the Morrisons and the Mossbergers, they were a bit excited. Not Fat Dad. He rode in like the cavalry, made peace with the neighbors. I sat on a rock in shock. As Fat Dad put his arm around me, I burst into tears. We can fix the fence. I'll buy another fountain. We can even replace that old car. Those are just things. But I could never replace you. Besides, the town will be talking about this for weeks. The lesson? Love. Now, teenage boys, they don't always think about cars. Sometimes they think about girls. Fat Dad overheard me and my buddies bragging about our adventures with women. Not being the shy type, he joined right in. Listened for a while, and then, like ice water thrown on you in a cold shower, said, "Boys, real men love for a lifetime, not for a moment." Ruined the whole conversation. But Fat Dad loved my mama. When they walked in the garden, or when they sat on the sofa, their hands always seemed to find each other. And when Mama was sitting watching TV, Fat Dad would come up behind her, wrap his strong arms around her, rest his chin on her shoulder, kiss her on the cheek. Oh, as a teenager, I couldn't believe old people carried on that way. But Fat Dad's love was more than romance. When my mama battled the cancer that eventually took her life, Fat Dad, like a good shepherd, caring for a wounded lamb, fed and bathed, read and sang to her. And when my mama's sunset fell and turned to starlight, Fat Dad held her close, whispered words of love and faith to calm her fear. Fat Dad's love for my mama was a gift to my wife and children, because watching him, I learned to love them for a lifetime. This year I had my first Father's Day without Fat Dad, and I miss him. But the lessons he taught me will last a lifetime. When you love, sometimes you're the catcher, sometimes you're the caught. When there's trouble, love rushes in, wraps its strong arms around you. Real men, well, they love for a lifetime, not for a moment. Fellow Toastmasters, the lesson is love. And I'm proud to tell you, my children call me Fat Dad.
Well, I was so glad to sit in on the presentation that we had before of Matt and Penny. I couldn't help thinking as I listened to their presentation how truly important what they were talking about is, for a variety of reasons. In 2004, before I competed in the World Championship of Public Speaking, in a period from, well, in August and through February, my stepmother passed away first. And on the day of her funeral, I was in an automobile accident, and so I didn't get to go to the funeral. I was in the hospital. Well, about 15 days later, I get a telephone call, and my father was killed in a tractor rollover accident. And I went out there to the scene where he was trapped underneath the tractor. He obviously had passed away. And the firemen were there trying to get the tractor off. And I told them I wanted to see him. And they said, no, you can't go there. Well, I'm a rather insistent only child. And so eventually they let me go. And I knelt down there where he was pinned under the tractor, and I brushed the hair out of his eyes, laid my hand on his forehead and prayed and said goodbye. And as I was walking away from the tractor, the scene of the devastation, I heard my father's voice as clear as you're hearing my voice right now. He said, "See, the cigarettes didn't kill me." He was a 3-pack-a-day smoker, and I said, "You know, you're going to die from cancer." And that was his parting shot. It was only a week and a half later that I got a call to come to my best friend's house. He had had a heart attack and died in the bathroom. So in a series of less than 45 days, I had 4 major tragedies in my life, and I was completely a wreck. I was completely broken. I was completely shattered. I was lost in this realization that there is mortality, that we're mortal, we're going to die. And all of a sudden, being a rock star at my job, where I was an HR director, I had made life and death decisions, at least career life and death decisions, hiring and firing. And I was a contract negotiator, as a chief negotiator. I negotiated the bargaining table with teachers' union. And that's hardball stuff, don't you know? And I had every answer conceivable. I could answer any question. I had the answers to everything. Just ask me, I could tell you. But in that 45-day period, that window, I lost all of that. And I was reading a story in the New Testament in daily devotions, and I came across this story of Mary coming to Jesus, and she had this alabaster box of great value, and inside was perfume. The alabaster box, we know from the history that that box in modern value was about $35,000. Had great value. And she broke that alabaster box. And she allowed the perfume to run down over Jesus' head and over his clothing, anointing him for the day that he would die, or so the scripture says. And in that moment, I had a realization, an epiphany, that in order for God to release in our lives that sweet fragrance that allows us to truly minister to other people, to touch their lives, to make a difference, he first has to break the alabaster box. And I realized that that 45-day period was the time where my box was broken. And I began from that day forward to begin to relate to people in a much more empathetic way. It was almost as if my own weaknesses, my own foibles, my own inabilities were all revealed. And instead of running from them, what I realized that to really release that perfume, I couldn't run from them. I had to embrace them. I had to experience them. And I had to experience that grief and loss and let it permeate through me in such a way that it released in me the power to be there for other people, to understand, to have compassion, and to speak. You know, prior to that day, or prior to that epiphany, I really had a problem letting my emotions out. I think probably I had not cried. I cried at the death of my son, and I cried at the death of my mother. But apart from that, I couldn't remember a time when I really got emotional about something, where something was really, I would let something touch my heart. And since that time, my kids point to me and laugh anytime there's a sad commercial on, you know, that because I tear up, because my heart is open to it. So I think it's really important, what was shared with you earlier. While you may not tell the gruesome details of your child molestation, I mean, I identify with you. I was molested as a child by a family relative, buried that, kept it down there. While you don't need to necessarily tell that particular story, you need to allow that pain work its work in you. You need to allow it to release in you the ability to touch people's souls in a way that they've not been touched. We've all had the experience where someone says, "Oh, I understand what you're going through." And we all say, "The hell you do. You have no idea what I'm going through." And those of us who've been through it, we don't say, "I know what you're going through." We reach out and hold them. We put our hand on them. We express to them how much we care about them, how much we're there with them. That's more powerful. Well, that was the stage for the writing of lessons from Fat Dad. Fat Dad was my dad. I called him Fat Dad. My grandfather was Fat Dad, and my great-grandfather was Fat Dad. And now 7 grandchildren call me Fat Dad. It's great. You know, in a crowded auditorium, and you hear this voice on the other side, "Fat Dad!" And everybody looks around to see who the fattest guy is in the room, right? Some people get offended, but... So when I wrote Lessons from Fat Dad, I was new to Toastmasters. I'd only been in Toastmasters less than a year when I competed. In November, I won the humorous speech contest with a speech titled "It Wasn't My Fault," which you heard last night. How many of you heard the 63 Volkswagen Beetle in the championship speech? True story, by the way. True story. Really wasn't a Mary Poppins fountain, but it was a very valuable fountain. What do you think? Our family motto is never let the truth get in the way of a good story. Yeah. So I was trying to come up with a speech. Well, I had joined Toastmasters. I competed in the humorous speech contest. I won the district contest in a time of 7 minutes and 29 seconds. Yeah, in fact, it was protested. The guy who came in second thought I went overtime, and he protested it. And so everybody was waiting for a half an hour while they were out there arguing in the hallway. And the reason I won is one timer had the watch in his hand, the other reached down and picked up the timer and then turned it off. And the district governor said, "We're going with the time, the guy who was holding it." And so I won, which is good. And then when I won the world champion, or when I was competing, the international contest comes next. And so I thought, well, the humorous was so much fun, I'll enter the international contest. But I didn't know it was an international contest because everyone referred to it as the inspirational contest. And I thought, well, that'll be fun. And so I wrote a speech called "Sticks and Stones Will Break Your Bones, But Words Will Never Hurt You." It's a lie. And I won district. But a week before the district contest, the district governor says to me, "Well, what are you going to do for your next speech?" I said, "What do you mean, next humor speech next year?" He says, no, "The regional speech." I said, "What's regional?" And he explained to me that, no, it's not an inspirational contest. It's an international contest. And you have 2 more speeches to give. And so I had to write a second speech. And the second speech I wrote was a speech that I really love. It's the title of one of my major keynotes: "Don't Settle for Greatness When You Can Be Immortal." And it's based on something my mother told me when I was growing up after I'd been expelled from school for the second time for 7 thumbtacks strategically placed to get a rise out of my science teacher. They were hilariously successful. Although I've discovered it's hard to deny your culpability when you're the one laughing so hard. Well, that night when I got home, my mama wasn't laughing. She treated me to a hickory stick waltz. You know what I mean? piece of kindling taken from the wood box, applied to your backside in steady rhythm. Of course, you sing along in keys, chords, and crescendos, right? Well, I finished writing that speech on the airplane flying from Los Angeles to Seattle, where the competition was. In those days, they had separate regional contests. And so I won that speech. And then I flew back to California and took the bar exam. A little stress in my life at that time. Then I started casting about for a speech for the international, because I had 10 weeks. In the first 3 weeks, I just could not come up with a title. I gave a lot of different speeches. I think the most poignant thing was from a district governor, Carol Petronic, who listened to one of the speeches I thought I would use, and she had a one-line critique. That sucks. You know? I said, that's not very toastmasterly of you to say that. She says, well, I can't help it. It sucks. So I was casting about trying to come up with a speech title, and I was reading again in the New Testament, I was reading the book of 1 Corinthians, which a lot of you, if you've been to weddings, it's a passage that always gets read. Love is always patient, love is always kind. And for some reason, I found myself asking myself the question, where have I learned that in my life? Where have I learned to love my wife, love my children, be straight and honest with my friends? And it struck me, those conversations with my father all those years, with Fat Dad. The conversation when I wrecked multiple cars, as you heard, and it wasn't my fault. Those three cars that I wrecked were in the space of a month. So, yeah. That wasn't all of them. I think there was like 9 or 10 in all in the first year of having a driver's license. Insurance rates were not good. It kind of came to a stop, though, when I T-boned our landlord in an intersection, and we got evicted from our house, and I lost my driver's license for a while. So I asked myself the questions, where did I learn that? And I started thinking about all the expressions of love, the lesson being love, and all those lessons I learned as a child growing up, and they just started overwhelming me, all these stories. So I wound up writing the speech that you saw today, Lessons from Fat Dad, the ultimate lesson being unconditional love. Because my father, even though he was a convicted felon and went to prison for armed bank robbery when I was 5, was the most loving man you could imagine. Went to all my baseball games, all my football games, just completely involved, but that conviction on his record haunted him the rest of his life. He could never get a job in any security position. He wound up being a used car salesman his entire life, which is good for me in my track record with cars. I always needed another one, right? So, Lessons from Fat Dad is really a eulogy. If you understand that, it begins to make sense. It's a eulogy to my father, Fat Dad. Fat Dad 3. I'm Fat Dad 4. And my son, though he keeps trying to fight it off, will be Fat Dad 5. He's 6'3", 270 pounds, so I think he fits the bill better than I do. Well, I want to talk to you today about this notion of letting your alabaster box be broken and releasing that fragrance that only you have. See, the one thing that I know about everyone, and it's not a cliche, there's no other you in the world. You're the only one. So you don't need to be a Randy Harvey or a Ross Mackay or even a Gary Moll or pick someone in the room. You don't need to be them. You need to be the best you that you can be. You need to take the gifts that you have, the voice that you have, and release it into the world. Now, I get asked this question all the time. You know, people call me and they say, I want you to mentor me. I want to be the world champion of public speaking. Give me the magic bullet that will let me win. And Ryan Avery was one of those people in 2012. And Ryan, I'd never met him before, came to my house and he said, I want to win the world championship. I said, I can't help you. He goes, well, you're a world champion. You can teach me what to do. And I said, I'm not going to teach you to speak so you can win the world champion. Well, why not? I said, because that's not what I do. That's not what I'm about. And he said, So, how can you help me? I said, well, first of all, tell me, who are you? He said, well, I'm Ryan Avery. I said, well, okay, that tells me what name you wear, but who are you? What is it that you believe in so strongly? What is the philosophy that you lived your life by? What is it that makes you you and different from anybody else on the planet? And I took him through three questions, which we will talk about in the time that we have today. The first question being, who are you? And that is the philosophy that governs your life. For some people, it's a religious philosophy. Some people, it's a spiritual philosophy. Some people, it's a political philosophy. Even if you say, I have no philosophy, you're just stupid. Because a philosophy is simply a collection of wisdom that you live your life by. And whether you believe you have one or not, you do. Right? Anybody put their hand on a stove when they were a child? Yeah. And how many of you have learned that you won't do that twice? Right? Some of us have done it twice just because we didn't believe it the first time. We grew up to be attorneys. Then we sue the stove. Right? The manufacturer. So, everyone has a philosophy. Most people just don't know what it is. Because you have a collection of wisdom, and that's what philosophy means. Philo, study, osophy, study of wisdom. Philosophy means the study of wisdom. And wisdom are those pearls that we collect that we live our life by. And everyone has a philosophy. Now, the second question then is, what are you about? What are you about? The question, what are you about, is what are the rules that you live your life by? Everyone has core values, absolute rules that they live by, things that they believe in strongly, perhaps so strongly they would sacrifice their life before they would give up that belief. You know, what is it that makes people, because of their religious faith, allow people to kill them rather than deny their faith? That's a core value, don't you think? It's so central to who they are that they would surrender their life before they would sacrifice their belief, their faith. And it's not just religious things. It's things that you believe in so strongly. So let me give you this analogy, and I've shared it in a number of conferences. Some of you may have heard it, but it's a good reminder. There's a difference between a core value, something you believe in so strongly that you'd give up your life before you'd surrender that value, and something you just believe. Because if you just believe it, you can change your mind, right? I believe I should be thinner. It's not a core value, because I'm not thinner, right? So imagine with me the Twin Towers in Chicago, over 1,100 feet in the air. There are no two Twin Towers in Chicago, but it's the only thing I could think of. Imagine two tall buildings over 1,000 feet high in the Windy City. The Windy City. It's January. It's snowing. It's blowing. People are bundled up. And across from these two buildings, on the very top of both, is a steel cable 3 inches in diameter. Did I say it was snowing? Did I say it was blowing? 15 knots. That's fast. Who in this room, without the aid of a net or any safety device, would walk across that steel cable unaided by any safety device for $1 million? Right? It's not worth the speaking fee, is it? Right. You wouldn't do that. You thinking maybe two? No, I didn't think so. You're just one of those, I think. Right, you wouldn't do it for money. That tells me money is not a core value to you. Now let's change the scenario. Now on the other side is your 15-month-old child hanging by their fingertips, about to fall 1,100 feet to a snowy earth. Now how many of you would cross? Some of you are holding out to find out which child it was. Now, which child, yeah? I have one of those. I have three. I have one of those. Well, everyone in the room, or most everyone in the room, would cross for to save a child, because a core value is that the life of a child is worth risking our own life, isn't it? Some of you, it wouldn't matter whose child it was, you would cross. And then the third question I asked, is it an important question, is where did you learn that? Where did you learn that? Where did you learn that core value? Now, I know that we don't learn our core values in a single place. We learn them, and then we accumulate more facts to support them through life. So, for example, how many of you can recall an event in your life when you learned not to lie? Raise your hand. How many of you remember an event in your life where you learned not to steal? That proves the point. There are a lot of liars and thieves among professional speakers. How many of you remember when you learned not to backtalk your mama? I never knew lava tasted like that. A 20 mule team borax in your mouth. Yeah, that's child abuse now. She'd go to jail for that. Amazing what we learned in those days, isn't it? The unique value of the third question, where did you learn that, is you're now talking about your stories. The things that happened to you. You see, can I get up and tell the story of where I learned not to backtalk my mama with passion? Why? I lived it. And one of the issues that speakers have is they get up, and we've all watched speakers get up and tell stories that are not their own, haven't we? Maybe freshly printed off the internet. Yeah. It's just not their story. And the telling of it is lifeless, isn't it? You know why it's lifeless to you? Because you're hearing it in monotone. You're hearing it as a radio voice. And you're sitting there watching the radio, like my grandmother and grandfather used to do. They used to watch the radio. Yeah, they did, didn't they? My father told me, oh, on Saturday night, we used to watch the radio. And I said, you did what? He said, we watched the radio. I said, how did you watch the radio? We all sat down on the floor and we watched the RCA play. The Shadow Knows.
Yeah, you can hear better.
Right. They watched the radio. Well, when I'm up here speaking, you're watching me speak. You're watching the 300 different muscles in my face for micro expressions. You're watching my eyes to see what I'm doing with them. And what I'm saying and how I'm moving is either verifying or contradicting what I'm saying to you. You're looking for the truth in the visuals. And if you tell your story, your body will line up, because the way the mind works, when you experience something, the mind records the memory of it, but it records all of the sensual, sight, sound, taste, touch, smell, all of the emotional, all six of the emotions, fear, joy, anxiety, happiness, sadness, fright, disgust. It records all of that. It records your emotions at the time. So as a speaker, if you tell your story, your body reinforces that with the audience when you're talking about it. Now, people commented about my facial expressions when I was talking about it wasn't my fault last night. It's not hard to have a facial expression of surprise when you actually crashed the car. You know, or when the hog actually stuck its tongue in your ear. I mean, that's an emotional experience. You're sweet 16, my first kiss. And it was a French kiss in my ear by a pig. You know, what is that about? So the three questions I asked Ryan Avery are, who are you? What are you about? and where did you learn that? And his speech, trust is a must, came from one of his core values. Trust is absolutely important. And then I asked him, well, tell me the stories where you learned trust is a must. And so he told me about when he lied to his mother about going to a party where he said there was no alcohol. And the sheriff arrested them. They were all on their hands and knees picking up soggy cigarette butts in the park most of the night. And that story won. It won because it was him. His facial expressions were there. It was his story. It was his power. It was his authority. So what I want you to get from these three questions is that you can strengthen your professional presentations by telling your story, by putting your story in it. But more importantly, back up a step from your story and put your core value in it. Now, our political system in America has kind of gone awry. It used to be that people could disagree agreeably, right? Now, if you disagree with a particular political position, you're a skank or a scab or all of the name-calling that goes along with it. You just can't disagree with me. Well, the world doesn't need more me's. And we need to have the opportunity for dialogue. And what I've discovered when I was negotiating contracts, and now as a trial attorney, as I stand in front of a jury or in front of a judge, a federal judge, I can take a position that people in that room don't like. But if I believe in that position, I can sell that position to a jury. You do not have to agree with me in order to believe that I believe what I'm saying. Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr., the last recorded meeting between those two men, Malcolm X is reported to have said to Martin Luther King Jr., "We have the same goal. We go about it in two different ways." Martin Luther King, the path of peace. Malcolm X, whatever path it takes to get even violence. Malcolm X said, "We are both about the same thing, but one thing we have in common, we are both dead men." Within 3 months, Martin Luther King died by the assassin's bullet. Within 3 years, Malcolm X followed, killed by the assassin's bullet. Now, either of those men at that point in time could have changed what they were saying. They could have began preaching, speaking a different message. And they would have lived. They would have lived. But they chose to pursue the path of their core values and belief because it's who they are. It's what they were about. And it's what they believed in strongly enough to surrender their life. If you speak from your philosophy of who you are, if you speak from your core values, you will have opposition. People have a hard time with strong voices, don't they? Look at our political leaders. Do they have an easy path? Barack Obama doesn't have an easy path. George Bush doesn't have an easy path. George Washington didn't have an easy path. He spent 8 years of his life running from the British, who would have gladly killed him. Abraham Lincoln, who we're going to talk about in a moment, did not have an easy life. What I know about the great speakers, and believe me, I have studied them closely, Winston Churchill and Abraham Lincoln. This is a book my mother gave me when I was a boy. It has no cover on it. It once had a beautiful leather cover on it, but somehow over the moving and so on, it came off. These are the speeches of Abraham Lincoln, a book written in the 1850s. And in reading the writings of Abraham Lincoln, I've discovered the secret to Lincoln's voice, the secret to Lincoln's power was this. He knew absolutely who he was. He wasn't pretty. In fact, I don't think he could get elected today. He's not pretty enough. He's gangly and tall, and he had a squeaky voice. But what I know about him is he was a true believer. Because what he spoke about, he thought about. He thought about for days and hours and weeks and months. He thought about and he toiled over the writing that he did. Abraham Lincoln, we know from the mountains of research that have been done on him, was a consummate student of language. He understood, and in fact, one of the controversies over the Gettysburg Address, which we're going to look at in a moment, one of the controversies is, which one is the true version? Because Lincoln had a habit of writing two versions of every speech. One version was the one that was published in the newspaper, because he knew that the reader of the newspaper wouldn't have the benefit of hearing his voice and seeing his facial expressions and his body movements and so on. And the other one was the speech that he delivered. He had a constant and continuous fight with his White House chief of staff, assistant speechwriter, who was actually an editor for a newspaper, a quite well-known editor at the time, who would take out all the commas that Abraham Lincoln put in his speeches, because he put commas in odd places. And after he would take them all out, he'd give the speech back to Lincoln, and Lincoln would put them all back in. Because Lincoln said to him, I put commas in so I know how I'm going to say it. His commas were his pauses. Lincoln toiled over what he had to say, and what he had to say, I think why Lincoln is such a great president and such a great man, is that he was his own man. Lincoln was who he was. He knew who he was, and he knew what he was about. And those two elements, the first two W's of the questions, who are you and what are you about, are the things that you need to capture and understand for yourself as a professional speaker. Because even if you don't say it pretty, if you believe it and it comes from your heart, people will listen. It's why my motto and moniker is, if you speak from your heart, the world will listen. If you speak from your heart, the world will listen. And I believe if you lead from your heart, the world will follow. But most importantly, if you live from your heart, you will always know joy. Because you will be where you need to be. You'll be the person that you were most satisfied with. So speak from your heart, lead from your heart, and live from your heart. Can we get that Gettysburg Address up on the screen? So I want to take you through and show you the Gettysburg Address. I've taken some time to analyze it. And this is a speech that I shared. What district are you in? Is it Jean?
Carol. District 40, Gary's district.
District 40, Gary's district. And you heard me giving Carol a hard time earlier today because I was in District 40 not too long ago and I was teaching on Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address and she was sitting in the back going, bullshit, bullshit. Abraham Lincoln didn't think about those things when he wrote that. I'm not exaggerating, am I?
No,
okay, good. I don't want to put you in a bad light. That's all right. I'm a Christian. I believe in repentance and forgiveness. Lincoln was a student of writing. He studied Aristotle. He thought about how to put pen to paper. And even from his earliest writings, we see that he really labored over how words went together. Now, I'm a professional member of the National Speakers Association, and I do trainings for the National Speakers Association in my own state of Oregon. And one of the things that national speakers, sometimes the professional speakers, make fun of Toastmasters, oh, they only give a 7-minute speech. Oh. And I always say, well, you know what I know about? I said, I can say more than 7 minutes than you can say in 70 minutes. Because I use words well. And by the way, you can't even give your introduction in 7 minutes, you know, because they kind of wander. One of the things that you need to learn to do, and hopefully you'll pick up some of these skills as we talk over today, is spend time working on sentences. short clips that you're going to give that really capture who you are and what you're about. You know, in Lessons from Fat Dad, there were three major legacy lines. Now, a legacy line is a line that you deliver that will last beyond you. It will be remembered. John Kennedy. Anybody recall a legacy line from John Kennedy? Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. That's a legacy line. It's also what's called a meta scream, M-E-T-A scream, S-C-R-E-A-M, and I'll explain more of that later. Because it burrows into your brain and it sticks. With Lessons from Fat Dad, I had a number of legacy lines. When you love, sometimes you're the catcher, sometimes you're the caught. What does that mean? Think about it. When you're in a loving relationship, sometimes they support you, sometimes you support them, right? Sometimes you rescue them, sometimes they rescue you. When they're adolescent teenagers and driving, you don't think that day will ever come, that they rescue you, but it does eventually. Let's see if we can open up just the text there. Close the bar on the left. Now you have this on your table as a handout if you want to pull that out. I apologize if it's not quite clear. It's also downloadable off my website, randyjharvey.com, this analysis. Lincoln was a consummate student of language, and whether or not he understood the use of simile, contrast, rhyme, echo, metaphor, I know that he understood those constructs because he used them all the time. He didn't put them in a structure necessarily like I'm going to share them with you today. The scream construct we're going to talk about is not something that's new to me, although I coined the phrase scream. Winston Churchill referred to it as cream. He left the S off for simile. Simile is actually a subcategory of metaphor, but it's something we Westerners in North America use an awful lot of similes, so I put it on. I want to look with you for just a moment at the Gettysburg Address, and it's kind of a foundation for how we're going to get to learning these scream constructs and organizational principles. The Gettysburg Address is 266 words, depending upon which version you're reading. It is 2.5 minutes in length, and when it was given, it got 5 standing ovations. The preceding speaker, many of you know, Everett, spoke for 2.5 hours. Edward Everett. Anybody remember Edward Everett? No, I didn't think so. 2.5 hours. Lincoln spoke for 2.5 minutes. Lincoln's, when he gave this address, the governor of the state, who was also a Republican, didn't attend because nobody thought Lincoln would get reelected and he didn't want to associate with them. Much like today, many governors don't go to where Barack Obama is because he's not popular right at the moment, so they don't want to hang with him. Well, this happened to Lincoln. And he was battling at the time. Lincoln was suffering from a bout of smallpox, and he was ill at the time. It was a mild case, but he was not feeling well at the time he delivered the speech. Talk about a broken alabaster box. Lincoln was a very sorrowful man. You know, he lost his son in the White House. He had bouts of depression, and he struggled through that. So he stood up to give this speech, and this speech is delivered on the Gettysburg battlefield not too long after the battle. In fact, there are still swords and bayonets and cannonballs and torn shreds of uniforms, broken caissons, strewn about him in the fields. And the audience is sitting in the center of this, surrounded by this battlefield. Not too far from there, all of the dead bodies were buried, and they were Union soldiers were dug up and replanted in the Gettysburg Cemetery. So he stands up to give this speech. Now his introduction is 6 lines here. Now Lincoln didn't write it this way. This particular structure, the way the speech is written, is called a commentary format. Some people refer to it as a poetry format or a prose format. And it's a good way for you as speakers to get your speeches down on paper. Write only as much on a line as you're going to say before you take a breath. When you pause, start a new sentence when you're writing your speeches out. All right, let's look at the speech. 87 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now that's his introduction. Let's take a look at it. Lincoln has 3 points in his speech. 3 messages he wants to get to the audience, and he gets them in there in about 35 words. About 35 words. The first point is the notion of the union. That the union is conceived, so he's talking about conception, the new birth, the live organism, the living organism, which is this nation. Now, nations are not organisms, are they? So he's talking about it metaphorically. So the first thing he communicates to his audience is this is a living cause we're fighting for. Second, he's asking his audience to be dedicated, devoted, and to consecrate themselves to the purpose of this endeavor in the Civil War, which is the Union, the preservation of the Union. And the third point, all men are created equal. And that is an unfinished work. Is it finished today? No. Would that it was, but it's not. It's not finished today. So as we look at his introduction, we see what he's done here. He's got rhyme. 84, 84. Hear that sound? The or and the or? It rhymes. 87 years ago, our fathers, and now he brings in metaphor. Metaphor is giving live or giving attributes to something that is inanimate as if it was a living object. In other words, the country's not alive, it's not a human being, but he's talking about it as if it is, if that is a metaphor. Giving human attributes to something that is not human. And so he develops for the audience this notion of the nation as a newborn child. And he goes through all of the salacious details. Conception, right? Some people say that he talks about conception because our nation is so screwed up. Think about that. Conceived in liberty, dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. So we've got a couple of things going here. Our fathers, metaphorically, George Washington, Jefferson, so on, conceived the creation, the life-giving effect of bringing a nation into effect. And he uses alliteration and a tautogram. So let's talk about SCREAM. That'll help you before we get too much farther here. SCREAM is an acronym. S-C-R-E-A-M. The S stands for simile. Simile is when you use in a sentence the words like or as. She is like a flower. He is like a stone. Right? Or vice versa. Or you're making comparisons where you're using like or as. I stood as a melting stick of butter in the broad daylight. So you're bringing to bear on the language, you're forcing the mind to make comparisons. You have to use your whole brain. The second element of SCREAM is contrast. Contrast. Contrast are opposites. Light, dark, fat, skinny, short, tall, happy, sad. Those kinds of contrasts. Next is echo. Echo. Echo is when you repeat a sentence. Repeat a portion of a sentence in the beginning and in the back. So for example, John Kennedy, ask not, ask what? Hear the echo? So ask is the echo in that phrase. Then we come to alliteration. Now, alliteration is in many forms. Most people think of alliteration in the form called a tautogram, where you have repeating consonants. Peter Piper picked a pack of pickled peppers. That's a tautogram with every word begins with the consonant P. That's a consonants, an alliteration in consonants. You can also have alliterations where they begin with vowel sounds. Right? Indiana is idiomatic. So we have a series of repeating vowel sounds. However, alliteration is far more powerful than just the first letter being the same on each word. It can also be a repetition of sounds and combinations of letters. For example, we will see in this speech, Lincoln uses alliterative diphthongs, TH, the TH sound, as in that and this. And he repeats it. It becomes very powerful. And then after alliteration, we have metaphor, and I've already explained that. So, metaphor. So we have the tautogram here, a new nation. Oh, thank you. Thank you for asking that. R for Randy. No. R is for rhyme, and it's very powerful. Rhyme exists in two forms. It exists in the poetic form where the words at the end of a sentence rhyme, and internal form. So you have an external form of rhyme and internal form. An external rhyme, words at the end of the sentence rhyme, and the internal form, you have rhyming words and sounds within a sentence. For us as speakers, the more powerful use of rhyme is internally, not externally. Because if you use external rhyme where you're rhyming words at the end of your sentences, people think you're just being cute or you're using a gimmick. But if you rhyme words within the sentences, they don't even realize that you're rhyming, but they know that they like it. So Lincoln says, conceived a new nation, conceived in liberty. So you have, look at the rhymes you already have here. Four and score, new nation. A lot of people don't know about Lincoln, and I only just recently discovered this through research and writings, that Lincoln was a closet poet. He started when, at a young age, writing poetry. There is no published poetry of Lincoln. He didn't publish it. In fact, he destroyed it. I believe that in reality there is one poem that was published in a newspaper by Lincoln. But anyone who's ever read the writings of Lincoln will see the poet in the words that he uses, because he understands language is music and it has to be fluid and it has to move you along in a way that you can experience each component. And so you see that. You see the lyrical quality here in his writing. Do you want to? Is there a trick to moving it up? So that's his introduction. And interestingly enough, in those few short words in his introduction, he captures three major points. And he's going to talk about those three points as he goes through the rest of his speech. Now, we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. Now, I want you to think about it, and you may want to take a moment and count the number of that's, the times that Lincoln used the word that in the speech. You should find about 9 of them. Let's look at this. Testing whether that nation or any nation. So Lincoln echoes nation in these two lines. And he echoes again here in dedicated. And we see here the rule of three. Testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived, so dedicated, can long endure. You see the three points? Interestingly enough, human culture focuses around several particular numerations. Seems like 3, 5, 7, and 9, based on the research, people remember things that are clustered in groups of 3, 5, 7, or 9. So women, do not send your husband to the grocery store with a list of 10 items. Unless you have it written down, and then you have a chance. But if you just ask him to remember 4 things, forget it. He'll come back with Sports Illustrated and a 6-pack of beer. So, rule of three. The other thing we see here is something very unique to Lincoln. It's called alphanumerism, where Lincoln uses a rule of three, but he does something special here. Look at the three significant words here in this rule of three. Or any nation so conceived, so dedicated, can long endure. And you notice that conceived, starting with C, is followed by the letter D, which is followed by the letter E, and he arranged them alphanumerically. And why is that? You would have never noticed it unless I pointed it out to you, would you? The reason is the human mind is an organized, lazy structure. Right? The mind tries to learn something and then never has to learn it again, right? So when we have a group of things we need to organize, a group of things in writing, how do we organize them? Alphabetically, right? Because we'll remember them. A, B, C, D, E, right? And if, yes, go ahead, Jean, or Carol.
I wanted to ask you a question on the 3, 5, 7.
Oh, please do. Oh, and by the way, ask questions. This is not one-way conversation, so ask questions if you have them.
3, 5, 7, 9, the Ten Commandments, I was going to write a handbook on the
right
shout of coaching.
Uh-huh.
And so are you saying that instead of having the 10 thou shalt nots, I mean thou shalt nots of
yeah
coaching? So do you say I should have only 7?
Well, you know, it's like I said to that group in Jordan when I was there. You know, God is a storyteller. If it's good enough for Him, I'm not changing it. There are exceptions to every rule. God has allowed an exception for a 10 commandments.
So it's okay if I do 10.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I've never thought of you as a deistic form, but.
But you took me 10.
Okay. So feel free to ask questions. Now, where was I before you sidetracked me? Alphanumerism. Lincoln also used reverse alphanumerism when he wanted to make people focus. So we have the rule of three, we have the alphanumerism here, conceived, dedicated, and endure. So in this segment, he again reinforces the conception and the dedication. And then we go to the next series of lines. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. Now, I want to point something out to you that Lincoln was doing in this speech, which is really interesting. They're sitting in the middle of the battlefield. And his purpose in coming there is to honor the dead, but also wants to rally these people to come together and move forward in support of resolving this conflict. And he uniquely starts here talking about that war that is out there, right? So he's externalizing this message. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field. Still externalizing. As a final resting place for those who gave their lives that that nation might live. First of all, notice all the that's. He's externalizing. He's focusing them outward. Now we see echo here. We are. We have. So he's using the word we to echo. It's powerful. Then he comes down here to metaphor as a final resting place. He's talking about their graves. For those who gave their lives, did they give it or did someone shoot them or blow them up? Someone took their life, right? So metaphorically, he's talking about their sacrifice. And that that nation might live. And we've already said, a nation is not alive. It's not a person. But he's also talking about, metaphorically, that nation that's out there that we're trying to save. So he's still externalizing. Look here. That war, that field, those who gave their, that nation, that we do this. You have a massive alliteration of the diphthong TH. And it causes this language to just flow through our mind because we have that repetition of the TH. All right, let's move up. We're about due to take a break, right? Okay. Yes.
Would that also be a bit of putting things in the past so they can move forward? I get a sense he's talking in sort of a past tense form.
Well, he's definitely talking about a past tense for the Battle of Gettysburg.
Yeah.
Some 50,000 people died. Right.
So they're not staying stuck in the one spot.
Correct. Yeah. It's an external focus to get them to think about what's happened here. Go ahead.
So the external, you've read a lot about him, but externalization, putting it out there, is that because the nation that he wants they don't have? Is that kind of where he's going?
Actually, what he's doing a unique thing here. He's using all of these things that are external, and in a moment he's going to suck it right in and stick it right where it belongs. And he's going to give them a challenge to take it up and do it. Because you'll see that that's changed to this. Okay. I think we jumped past something there. Did we go too far down there? I think we jumped a few. Okay. Yeah, it is altogether fitting and proper that we do this. That that nation might live, it is altogether fitting and proper that we do this. Little double entendre here. Honor the dead, perpetuate the union. And we also see here a bit of oration where you fluff things up and you gild the lily, so to speak. That we should do this. So that is starting to come home to the people who are going to carry the water, right? He's been talking externally, but now he's starting to move it towards an internal recognition and an internal commitment. That we should do this. And so now he's talking about their individual responsibility. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. What do you notice about dedicate, consecrate, hallow? Alphanumerism again, correct? Ah, good. You're awake. The D, he mixed it up here, didn't he? Makes you think. The concern here, the combination of these three elements in size and significance, dedicate, consecrate, and hallow, the word is misspelled. It's not H-O-L-L. It's hallow, H-A-L-L-O. Right. This ground. And then he goes to metaphor here. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have consecrated it far above our internal rhyme, poor power to add or detract. So we have contrast here, add or detract, living and dead. Metaphor, the brave men living and dead have consecrated it far above. Their blood has consecrated the ground. We have the alliteration, the consonants here, two P's. And by using the scream and you know, weaving it into the message. This speech, if you just read it all the way through, it's like listening to a short symphony, a melody that just plays. It's powerful. It resonates in your being. And the reason that it resonates so strongly is what it's doing in your brain. Because in order to engage in metaphor, if I say, she is a rock full of crags and soil in its crevices. Well, you have to think of the she, and many of you will recognize the she immediately. You have a person when I say she's a rock full of crags and crevices, right? Or his is a face like a county road full of potholes and divots. Worn well by the years. So what happens here is I'm saying he is, you get the image of who I'm thinking, who you're thinking about, and you immediately go into your mind and start grabbing images and pictures and pulling that in. You know, someone said earlier last night, or maybe it was this morning, you said a picture is worth 1,000 words. And I was asked that in a Table Topics not too long ago. A picture is worth 1,000 words. My opening line was, that's not true. A picture is worth a lifetime. Millions of things that are so undescribable and so incomprehensible. I think of the photo of my wife and I on our wedding day, a particular photo where she's looking up at me and there's that glow on her face and I'm looking down at her. So much in love, so long ago, still true today. And I could not describe that image with 1,000 words because it resonates in my heart, in my being, with all the memories of holding my children and my grandchildren are all wrapped into that one image. So when we cause the audience through the use of these scream constructs to go into their mind, they grab their images, right? And when you're using your images to fill out my message, whose speech is it? Ours. I always get asked, one of the questions I get asked is why more women don't win the world championship of public speaking. Have you ever heard that question asked before? I'll tell you why. They're far better speakers than men. That's why they don't win. And you might say, well, no, wait a minute, that's a contradiction, that's a paradox. The reason is that women, scientifically, women develop language sooner than men. Girls speak sooner than men, or boys. They have larger vocabularies than most boys. Women have larger vocabularies. Women communicate far better than men. Am I lying, women?
No.
In fact, You try to carry on a conversation with us sometimes and you get frustrated in communicating with us because you want to give us the details and we don't want them. Correct? Well, in the International Speech Contest, we know, and each of you have a different rate of speech, but on average, most men speak about 125 words a minute. Women speak 140 words a minute on average. People from New Jersey have bursts of up to 400 words. But on average, that's how quickly you speak. And women, bless your heart, you're far better communicators than men, and you love to give all the details just as a matter of the fact that you're more communicative. I know this. I have 2 daughters and a wife, right? They go to the store, they go shopping, they touch every piece of clothing in the store, they buy half of it, they bring it home, and the next day they take it all back, right? And in the course of doing that, they talk to everyone, right? They know the story about the woman at the check stand who's going through a divorce, right? How do they get that information out? And they do, but they talk. So what happens is in the international contest, women have far better prepared speeches. They're structurally written better, but they don't win. Why? My analysis, my experience, just my opinion, don't shoot me for it, don't shoot the messenger, is it's too detail-oriented. And I'll illustrate it in this way. Too detail-oriented, yes. It's too detail-oriented. And often it's in passive voice versus active voice. Do you know what I mean by the difference between passive and active? Well, I'll tell you. Active voice, John kicked the ball. John is the subject, kicked is the verb, ball is the object of the kick, right? The brain processes that very quickly. It's just a straight shot, you can process it. In my legal profession, oftentimes I will say, the ball was kicked. That's passive voice. I don't say the ball was kicked by John, because then they would convict my client. Right? And believe it or not, attorneys cannot lie in court. In fact, we can be disbarred for lying to a judge or in front of a jury. So it's not a lie to say the ball was kicked. It's true, right? I just don't say John kicked the ball. So women, sometimes, men do it too, communicate in the passive voice. Men who win the world championship don't communicate in passive voice. Men who lose the world championship do communicate in passive voice. So short, direct sentences. And I'll give you an example, because some of you are struggling with what I'm telling you. So I'm going to tell you a story, two versions of it, and you tell me which one has more meaning to you. Right? Last November, we got into our Volvo station wagon, a beautiful blue color, and drove through the lovely Oregon woods, the sun dancing on the vehicle as we drove through the different bursts of sunlight, to grandmother's house. As we pulled into the gravel driveway, the kids jumped out of the car, ran up the back porch, threw open the screen door and into grandma's kitchen. And there were two deep dish apple pies, freshly bubbling syrup across the top, and a golden brown turkey fresh out of the oven. We ate till we could eat no more, and in the afternoon we went out in the backyard and we had a huge snowball fight. I hit Uncle George in the side of the head with an ice ball the size of a basketball. Right? That's the story. It's a nice story, don't you think? It was pleasant. You enjoyed it. Some of you, I about put you to sleep. It was not bedtime. So let me tell you this story in another way. Different way. Last Thanksgiving, we went to Grandma's. Deep dish apple pie, golden brown turkey. Snowball fight in the backyard. Notice the difference? See, I didn't give you all the details, did I? In my world championship speech, I said, safety is a flannel shirt that smells of cherry tobacco. Now, what color was the shirt?
Red.
It's different for all of us.
It's different to all of you. It's different to all of you. I didn't say what color it was. And who was wearing the shirt in your experience?
I don't have that experience.
You don't have an experience of wearing a flannel shirt?
No.
I asked one audience.
My life is
huh?
My life is sadly lacking.
Oh, well.
Flannel shirt.
Try it. Flannel shirt. I was in one audience and the woman said I was. I wear one to bed every night in the wintertime. Flannel shirt. The point is for many of you, you saw your grandfather or your father or an uncle or someone who was special to you. How many of you smelled tobacco? Right? How many of you smelled some other flavor than cherry? Even though I said cherry tobacco, some of you, what flavor did you smell? Yeah, a pipe. Yeah. Well, here's something you should know. The best memory device is smell. If you can smell it, you can remember it. It's very powerful.
Are you saving to the end the value that endeared me to you?
What's that?
I said, are you saving to the end your family value that endeared me to you?
What family value is that?
And the phone in your office.
Huh?
Your family. You're always there for your family.
Oh, yes. Did you have a question? Okay. You got to be careful raising your hand. My uncle bought a bull that way once. No, seriously, it's true. He was sitting at the auction and he talked with his hands. And he was sitting next to his friend, Digger Barnes, who was a local mortician. And he was talking to him like this. And every time he'd go like this, you'd hear somebody up front go, hep, 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 sold! $8,000 bull. My uncle turned around and he goes, who bought that bull? And Digger goes, you did. So your question, Maureen.
What color was the bull?
It was actually a Hereford bull.
No, but I love this stuff. When you talk about giving just enough information for us to fill in the rest of the picture.
Right.
But what I have found, too, is you have to, for example, I told a story where a kid was playing with their car trucks, the toy trucks. And then a few minutes later, I referenced, and then the little child took his toy car and did something.
They said, no, it wasn't a car, it was a truck.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I thought, how could I have changed that? But what if I said toy vehicles? Because then it doesn't matter if it's a car or a truck. So it's a matter of giving enough information.
Yeah, he was playing with his toy. And all you have to do is this, and then it's...
But don't be so specific
right.
That now you cause your audience right. To go out on a rabbit trail.
Right. Well, and that's a huge problem. And I'll tell you where that happens most often is people will be on the platform and they'll tell a story. He was playing with his pet alligator, right, in the swamp. And then they go over here and I was running from a lion. Right into the swamp, hit by an alligator, right? So what happens is the mind, when you tell a story to an audience and they begin to visualize it, when you, this process, by the way, is called enthymeme. 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 It originated with Aristotle. It's creating something in the mind of the audience, the listening audience. So what you need to know is when I said, and think about lessons from Fat Dad. There were three key things that I said. Real men love for a lifetime, not for a moment. And I told that right here on the platform. I told Fat Dad held her close and whispered words of love and faith to calm her fears right here. And over on this part of the stage right here, I said, sometimes you're the catcher, sometimes you're the caught. So then when I did my conclusion, it's my first Father's Day without Fat Dad and I miss him. But the lessons he taught me will last a lifetime. When you love, sometimes you're the catcher. Sometimes you're the caught. So I went right back to that spot. And what happened when I did that, it brought up the holographic memory of that story that was told just minutes before right there. When you're in trouble, love rushes in, wraps its strong arms around you, right? Right there is where that happened. Real men, they love for a lifetime, not for a moment. So holographically, I retold those stories in the exact same locales. And when I concluded my speech, much like Lincoln, who had 3 points when he started, I took my 3 major points when I concluded, and I took you right back to each of those points because I knew that you would replay them in your mind when I did that. And there's a reason for that. There's a reason why introductions and conclusions are important. Number one is called primacy. We remember what we see or hear first. That's our strongest memory. First impression is the biggest memory that you'll have. So second, and I'll go back to first. Second, no, the first words you speak are the most important words you speak as a speaker. So don't waste them on, I'm glad to be here today. Stand and deliver. The first 35 words are when you make an impression on the reptilian brain of the audience. And they will remember that more than any other part of your speech. But that's not your first impression. That's your first auditory impression when your speech begins. Your first impression is when you're over here by the steps. And they say, our next speaker, Dr. Randy Harvey. Now, I don't have to say I'm glad to be here today, do I? Because of the way I entered. And when I'm done speaking and I've just given the speech of my life, how do I exit? Right. What I notice about winners, they exit like this. Lots of energy, right? First impression, last impression. The first rule of primacy, they remember what they hear and see first. So your entrance onto the platform is important. And I understand, ladies in high heels, you're not going to run on the stage necessarily. Or you might really make an impression. Right? But you can walk on quickly looking at the audience, right? You can have energy in your step. And then the last one is recency. People remember the most recent thing that they heard when you exit. So primacy and recency. We use this in the courtroom all the time. People remember the first thing that they heard and the last thing that they heard, right? When the jury goes into the jury box, I want the last thing that I said them ringing in their ears. Right? Primacy and recency. All right, let's finish out here. Let's go to the conclusion. A little bit further, I think. Yes.
When you were talking about, you know, cutting to the chase, condensing those things to the dorky questions, but with pronouns, from a speaking point, not a writing point, we just start off with, like, we, you know, your family, extended family, just children, or is that detail not even important? It's just we, and then you just move on.
Well, it really, in writing, what I do is this is a good point to introduce this concept. It's called the speaker's paradox. The speaker's paradox. It's actually, well, everything I'm teaching today is in the book, Messages That Matters. The speaker's paradox is in this book, but it's actually one of the mistakes in the book, so I'm going to tell you what it is. Speaker's paradox is this. You will never become a great speaker by writing your speeches. However, you will never become a great speaker without writing your speeches. Therein is the paradox. You'll never become a great speaker by writing your speeches. However, you will never become a great speaker without writing your speeches. Therein is the paradox. And the explanation is this. Most people, when they sit down to write their speech, they write it the way they learned in 8th grade English. Complete sentences, noun-verb agreement, proper capitalization, all of the rules of English. And how many people in North America speak that way? Nobody. Nobody. Not even federal judges speak that way. Unless they're reading. Of political speakers, President Obama comes the closest because he's the best teleprompter reader. Right? George Bush. He had a vast library. Some of the books had been colored in. That was terrible. Yeah. Now, I've adopted the stance that I will be critical of all of them. So, recently I criticized President Obama on a Facebook post because he went to the memorial service in England or France, it was in France, where 9,000 Americans were buried and Frenchmen and people. And while he was on the platform, he was chewing gum. And I was critical. If you're going to speak to an audience at a sacred event, don't chew gum as a speaker. And somebody said, "You're just being critical of the president." I'm going, any Toastmaster in the universe would be critical of chewing gum on the platform. Come on. And he unfriended me. I went, well, good. I'm glad that happened. So here's the thing. Do not write your speeches that way. So what I do is I will get up and I'll deliver a speech and I will record it. And I'll just use an outline to deliver the speech. So write an outline of the things you want to say. Get up and deliver the speech. And then transcribe that speech. But when you transcribe it this way using the commentary format. So every time you pause, start a new sentence. Double space so that you can read it. Now the power of this The power of the commentary format is it teaches you the musical lyric of your own voice. Teaches the melodic lyric of your own voice, the way you speak, the way you pause. It puts it all in there. Is it easier to remember a poem or a song?
Song.
Why? Because you have an underlying lyric that helps, or melody that helps you keep track of where you are. Well, you need to learn the melody of your own voice, because we all have them. And when you record yourself and then transcribe that speech in this way, you're actually reinforcing the way you speak, and you know where to pause. What I discovered in training mentees, if they use the auditory editing process, this commentary format that I teach them, they actually memorize their speeches in less than a third of the time that it normally takes. Because now, they're not trying to memorize some formal diatribe that they've written the way their eighth grade language teacher would be proud of. They're remembering how to speak in their own voice. It's very powerful. So the speaker's paradox. Don't write in formal English, write in your own voice. And it will be powerful. And Lincoln wrote in his own voice. Lincoln had the ability through practice of sitting down and writing in his own voice. All right. The world, I love, this is my favorite line in Lincoln's speech, line 27 and 28. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here. But it can never forget what they did here. Wow. How much is packed into that? We don't remember Edward Everett, who spoke for 2.5 hours, but this is the most memorized speech in American history. So we have the contrast. Do you hear the little note? Nor long remember what we say here. There's a great book that I'm reading right now on my iPad by Magnus. I'll have to pull it up and give you the name of the book. But it goes into this whole analysis of phonemes and morphemes. A phoneme is just the single sound of a letter, like a letter B, or the letter N, or the letter S, which is a phoneme. A morpheme is a collection of letters that is undividable. So, for example, incoming is a word. The morpheme would be in, it's undividable, two letters. Come, you can't have the word without the C-O-M-E. And the ing is undividable. So those are morphemes, right? Well, interesting thing about phonemes is that they group. There are clusters of them that they group together. Well, I'm not going to go into the great lecture on phonemes and morphemes, lest your eyes truly glaze over. But what I want you to note here is one of the powerful phonemes, or one of the powerful phonemes in this is the letter N. And it's alliterative. The world will little note nor long remember. Now that note nor is powerful because of the phoneme N, but the transition of the vowel O. In the first word, it's long. In the second word, it changes. Listen to the transition of the letter O. The world will little note nor long remember. And the reason I'm pointing that out is that it's what gives Lincoln's speech its lyrical qualities. Why it makes it so enjoyable to read this speech. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here. But it can never forget what they did here. So you have the contrasting here. We say here, they did here. You also have the echo of the hearers. What we say here, what they did here. You have the what, the echoing what's here. Remember what, forget what. Remember and forget are contrasts. Right? Now, one of the things I didn't share with you about scream is that screams exist at three levels. The first is a simple scream. It's either a simile, contrast, rhyme, echo, alliteration, or metaphor. The second level is called a compound scream, where you take two scream structures. You may have two similes, or a contrast in a simile, or an alliteration in a simile. You put them together and you have a compound scream. Well, think of it as increasing your dosage of cocaine. Because that's what it does to the brain. Because when we get to the third level of meta-scream is multiple scream constructs combined in a single sentence. So let's look at this. The world will little note nor long remember. Do you hear the rhyme? It also has a metaphor, doesn't it? And you have contrast. So you have echo, internal rhyme, contrast, and metaphor. You have four scream constructs in there. It's a high cocaine dosage. The brain is really eating it up. And you're not even thinking about it as a listener. You're just listening to it, but you like it and you don't know why. The reason you like it is because these scream constructs are firing around in your brain like missiles going off, capturing all these different components of memories and social psychological experiences, and causing you to really think about things in your own life and compare and contrast. And all of that's happening in milliseconds. Okay. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather to be dedicated here to the unfinished work. Now remember earlier I was talking about the that, focusing outward? Now he's pulled it into the here. And he's focusing it on the listener. Rather to be dedicated here to the unfinished work, which the men who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last measure of devotion. That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain. So what you have here too is Lincoln's love of progression. Dead, died, dying. Right? Remember all of that we did in grammar school about the progression of words and their present tense, past tense, future tense? Lincoln's making use of that. So you also have the internal rhyme here, that we here highly resolve. Do you see the alliterative H? The consonants of the H? High, here, high. Internal rhyme. And then let's go to the closing of the speech, the conclusion. That this nation, that this. See the contrast just in those two words, that this nation under God shall have new birth of freedom. Now remember in our introduction, Lincoln introduced birth, didn't he? Conceived. Shall have new birth of freedom and government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Yes?
So Penny and I were in the ladies' room talking.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We were both on the same track. I was like, wow. Like, Lincoln sat there and the world will...
No, I don't think Lincoln... I don't think Lincoln sat down... Yes.
Really?
Yes, let me read you something that he wrote 20...
I think he was naturally... Wow, it's a lot of thought put into this.
Let me tell you about Lincoln. If you read Lincoln's Sword, at the age of 7, he became enamored with words. He didn't have paper, so he would take a stick or a piece of charcoal and write sentences on pieces of bark that had been peeled off of trees that he was working on. 20 years before he was president, he wrote this, which is something that we hear from time to time. This is in one of his speeches. I answer, if if it ever reach us, it must spring up amongst us. It cannot come from abroad. If destruction be our lot, we must ourselves be its author and finisher. As a nation of free men, we must live through all time or die by suicide. 20 years before he was president. So Lincoln was amazing. If you read the history of his, read Carl Sandburg's history of Lincoln, his autobiography about his youth. He was an amazing fellow who read everything, pondered things, would write things until he could say it in a way that would capture what he really felt, what he really believed, and then he would own it. I had an experience a while back in Australia where I was invited to speak at a conference, and I'd spoken 3 times during the day. I was exhausted, and they had their evening banquet, and they were having an award ceremony. And I was sitting at the head table with my wife, and I'm enjoying the rubber chicken, right? Not really, but I was eating and I was hungry. And Michael Said came up to me and he tapped me on the shoulder and he says, "Dr. Harvey." I said, "Yeah, Michael, what's going on?" He goes, "I forgot to tell you, you're speaking tonight." I said, "Well, what am I speaking on?" "We want you to talk about motivation." I said, "Okay, well, when do I speak?" "You go on in 3 minutes." I said, "Thank you, Michael." 3 minutes later, I got up. I gave a 15-minute talk, and I got a 3-minute standing ovation. And Michael came up to me after and he goes, "Dr. Harvey, how did you do that? You only had 3 minutes." I said to him, "I've been writing that speech for 40 years. Why is that? It is because I use this commentary format. So when I got up to speak, I told 3 short stories that I had written out using the commentary format that I had mastered and told hundreds of times in other venues. If you take the time and spend the time on this segments of speeches that you do and develop 5-minute segments of speeches and really work them so that you have your legacy lines in there, your Lincoln-esque approaches of notes and knowers and this, that's and that's and this is. If you work that out in those stories, in those dark moments, in the dark recesses, in the early hours and the late evenings, then when you're called on with 3 minutes notice to get up in front of an audience and speak, your mind can go back into that Rolodex. Yeah, this audience is old enough to know a Rolodex. Go back into that Rolodex. You know, sometimes when I speak to children, I have to say, "You'd go back into that Oracle database and pull up those stories." But you can pull them up and deliver them, and people go, "How'd you come up with that? You only had 3 minutes." In reality, I'd been working on it for 40 years. Ross?
It reminds me very much of Churchill.
Yes.
Who was the same way throughout his entire career. He was constantly writing.
Always.
But when he had to deliver, he had already had it there.
Yes, let me, and on that note, there's a great book for you to get by James Humes. James Humes, H-U-M-E-S. Any book by James Humes is worth owning and adding to your library. He's written about 9 books. For my mentees, there are 2 books I make all of them purchase and read before we begin our first session. The first book, of course, is Messages That Matter, because I'm going to be teaching them all the things I've been teaching you today, and I want them to have read the material before we have our discussion. And the second book I have them get is a book called Speak Like Churchill, Stand Like Lincoln. Speak Like Churchill, Stand Like Lincoln. It's 21 chapters. Each chapter deals with a different aspect of speaking. You'll find in chapter 14 Winston Churchill's cream methods. I've shared with you today the scream methods. Only the S is mine. Churchill owns the cream. James Humes, right. It's paperback. You can get it on Amazon for under $10 or at $10. Mine, I have several copies. I keep losing them. One of the sweetest things that happened to me in the recent past, on my birthday, my last birthday, I turned 61, Ryan Avery and Chelsea came to our house, and he gave me a present. And I opened it, and it was my copy of Speak Like Churchill, Stand Like Lincoln that I had given to him when I started coaching him. And when I opened it, there was a handwritten note from James Humes.
Yeah.
I was so mad at him. I said, how in the hell could you go to Arizona and meet with James Humes and not tell me and invite me to go along? He wasn't that offended, but it was a very, very sweet gesture. So Churchill was marvelous in doing that. Churchill used the commentary format almost exclusively. Most of his speeches were by radio. And he was such an artful dodger. He wanted the audience to think that he was delivering this extemporaneously. So he would put a line in and dot, 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 and the word. And when the audience heard it on the radio, they'd hear him go, and an iron curtain fell. He knew exactly what he was going to say, but he wanted the audience to think he was reaching for a word. Okay, I'm going to take a few minutes and answer questions. I think I'm out of time, close, but go ahead.
Are we out of time? I just wanted to kind of add on to what Annette started to say about our conversation in the classroom about because this is really deep stuff, and I think that he probably was gifted with, you know, having this art or this talent. And so how can we as speakers tap into this?
Well, you know, you're really talking about the age-old argument. Okay, I'm sorry.
So I think that, and as I've repeated to say, in writing my book, sometimes I would write some stuff, and then I would go back and read it and think, wow, where did that come from? Was that me that wrote that? Because I think that there is a gift of knowing when you are clear and you are in your spirit is in tune and you are aligned, like I spoke about earlier, with integrity and authenticity, that there becomes a clearing or a channel to which you can create a masterpiece like this without even really knowing all of the details about it.
Yeah, really what you're talking about, I mean, I wrote my first novel in January of 2013, 480 pages. And I had never... Have you read it?
I have.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I gave you a copy of it.
Gave it to me.
You bought it? Thank you. I wondered who bought that copy. let me finish the point I'm making here. What you did unknowingly is you tapped into that philosophy that has developed in your life that you really didn't contemplate. Our philosophy and our core values float around in our brain unrecognized. But when we open the channels and allow it to come forward, it will. And as speakers, you can do that. You can open the channels and allow who you are to just pour forward on the pages or on into the text of the speech. It's very powerful.
But you have to have a clear channel.
Yes.
That's the work. That's why it's valuable for us to be doing our own work.
Absolutely.
And staying clean and clear.
Absolutely. Carol has asked me to talk about my family values for just a second. I have and what she's talking about, I believe, is the core value that I have: if they call me, I will come. I have a rule in my law practice and in my home, in my work, and everything that I do, that if my family calls me on the cell phone or at my office phone, I'll take the call. If I'm with clients, I'll excuse myself. If I'm in the mediation, I'll excuse myself, I'll take the call. So I have this rule: if they call me, I will answer. If they need me, I will come. And, you know, I told the story there of my son-in-law who was stranded When my youngest grandson went into the hospital, he was stranded on military maneuvers in northern Oregon. And he called me about 10 o'clock at night, and I was watching my mother-in-law, who has dementia, who's 85. And so packed Grandma into the truck, and away we went, round trip, 4-hour trip. But, you know, the one thing I recall from my own father is if people were broken down by the road, he'd stop. Drove my mom nuts. Hey, they may be axe murderers. What are you stopping for? He'd say, baby, I've been broken down by the road so many times in my life. I remember as a kid being packed in the back seat with four other kids, my mom and dad and two adults in the front seat of our car, driving to a gas station, and then turning around and driving them back 20 miles. And, you know, when you're 9 or 10 years old, those memories impress you. So, family. So let's just do some question and answers. I always like to get questions. Halim.
So this does seem like a monumental task to kind of master these strategies. What practices or disciplines do you suggest we as speakers develop to make sure maybe at the end of 5 years we get there instead of not getting there?
Good question. I think we have to be, if you're going to be a student of your craft of speaking, be a student. Have a notepad. I have this notepad I keep notes in. I have another small tablet. I always keep a tablet. And I listen. Whenever someone's speaking, I listen for how they say things, what they do. It annoys my wife to no end, although I've noted. She goes, did you hear how many times Barack Obama said, or "uh"? I think he does that more than George Bush does. So, I've ruined listening to speakers for my wife. But I think you have to be like Churchill. At age 19, Churchill decided he wanted to become a speaker. And he wasn't, I believe he had a lisp or a stutter when he first started. What he did was, is he got a notebook. And he was sent off into the Legion, or he was sent to India, I think. Not sure, don't hold me to that. Well, yeah, it was. So the Boer...
South Africa,
thank you. Okay. So he was sent to South Africa, and he kept a notebook. And he took notes on every speaker. The bad speakers, he took notes on their speaking. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do that. He wrote it down. For the good speakers, he paid attention. And he kept an ongoing record of all the speeches that he had. One of his favorite things to do was lay bricks. He was not a bricklayer, but he had an employee who was, and so he had him teach him to lay bricks. And he would go out and lay bricks and work on his speeches while he was laying the bricks and dictate them and get them back and edit them. And so the thing to do is whenever you speak, record your speech. Transcribe your speech. Once, and I didn't talk about this, so let me talk about this for just a minute. When you're using the auditory editing, the first time you deliver your speech, record it. Transcribe it. After you've transcribed it, and by the way, don't cheat. Transcribe it the way you said it. If you said put on there. If you said boo, put it on there. Boo, put it on the speech. Then, once you get it all transcribed, turn the recorder on again and listen and read along as you're listening to your voice with a highlight pen. And highlight the parts of the speech that you think you want to change. Now, don't go right out and take your 45-minute keynote that you give as your bread-and-butter speech. Don't go out and try to do all of this with that right now. You won't ever get it done. You'll get distracted and you'll never go through the auditory process. Take a portion, take 4 or 5 minutes of your speech and transcribe it and work on that 4 or 5 minutes, a chunk. I call a 5 to 7 minute a chunk in a keynote because 5 of them you have a regular keynote, right? Or 6 of them. So work on that 5 minute chunk, transcribe it, listen to yourself give it, and listen carefully. Because you never hear yourself speak unless you've listened to a recording of yourself. And when you hear yourself speak, you go, I don't sound like that. But yes, you do. Because when we hear our voice, we hear it through the bones and flesh in our face. We don't hear it directly through our ears. When we listen to the recording, we're hearing it like everybody in the audience hears it. And that's the way you need to hear it. Because then you can edit it for sound. One thing Lincoln told his editor of his speeches, I write for the ear, not for the eye. They're not going to read it. He wants them to hear it. So other questions? Anyone? Yes, another one, Halim? Then I'll go to you, Nate.
We talked about how we do not want too many details in a story and we want to leave some of them out for the listeners to fill in. Then I've also heard the advice that we want to avoid generalities when we're speaking. For example, instead of saying, the guy picked me up, you say the uniform driver because that puts an image.
Mm-hmm.
So where's the balance? Where do we leave out the details and where do we actually add details?
Okay, the question is how, you know, on the one hand I said don't give too many details, but how do you give enough details to get them interested? Well, go back to the grandma's story, right? I did say deep dish apple pie, didn't I? I didn't say apple pie. I could have said deep dish pies, which probably would have been better. I said, went to grandma's house, deep dish pie, golden brown turkey. Right? So if I had just said deep dish pie, what pie would you have thought of? Maybe your favorite? Right? So the only time you really have to give details is when details are important. So if the detail is not critically important to the speech, you don't need to include that detail. Nate, and then we'll come over here to you.
It's actually tying back to your championship speech video.
Okay.
And it's something that I've thought about for a while, and I've had some issues with it. It's the time, space, continuity.
Right.
In speech, like with your championship speech,
you're would you go ahead and get the championship speech ready to play one more time?
But there's obviously periods of time and even space that you jump to and from.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I'm looking at it again from that writing standpoint that sometimes how do you handle those sudden shifts where it's a kid, you're a teenager, father's on the couch, now...
That's an excellent point. When you write, you have to use connectors like if, and, or, but, nor. Right? If, and, or, but, nor. In speaking, I kill practically every and in every speech that I see. You don't need them. You don't need the connectors. So instead of saying, last November we went to grandma's house and we had dinner, right? Say, in November we went to grandma's house, had dinner, right? By eliminating the connectors, then you keep the audience in the present moment. If you say and, it's a word the brain doesn't hear anyway, because it's an insignificant word, but it does throw a jab in there. Now, if you're talking about changing, if I'm talking about when I was a teenager, when I was 7, when I was 35, right? So, use of platform choreography can be helpful by moving back. It has the chronological effect of moving back in time. It also, if you're talking about being sad, I was broken. I was battered. I was falling apart. Right? So when I'm doing that, by backing it up, that negative movement, backing away, reinforces the negative emotion. By the same token, if I say, there's one thing you need to know. It's really critical that you hear this. By moving forward and moving forward quickly, it creates energy in the audience. Whereas moving back is anxiety producing. Or if you really want to get a negative message to an audience, do this. Right? Where you're backing away and getting smaller. Yes, you had a question. Do you had a question?
Just to move by saying, another person is here. I like the way Abraham Lincoln built up this story. He started in the first paragraph, he starts from a position of being equal, created equal. Then he goes to great civil war. Then third paragraph, great battlefield. Next one, large ascent. Then he comes down to little man. Mm-hmm. So I like the way, you know, that
right. kind of thing. One of the things I didn't talk about was the rule of four. You've heard the rule of three, correct? The rule of four is a little different. It's a magnification of the rule of three. It works like this. We cannot dedicate. We cannot consecrate. We cannot hallow this ground. Now that's a rule of four accelerating, where each segment gets a little more energy and a little more volume. And by using a rule of four accelerating, I put energy into the audience. We cannot dedicate. We cannot consecrate. We cannot hallow. Pause. Rest. This ground. Right? So I bring the audience to rest. Very powerful. Now, if you want to put energy in the audience, use a rule of four ascending, where you're doing three. And I thought about this last night in your butt speech. I love this. Morgan MacArthur did it this way. I could be skinnier, but I won't diet. I could get a better job, but I won't work at it. I could do this, but if I don't get off my butt, I'm not going to get anything done. Right? So I used a rule of four ascending, but pause. But if I don't get off my butt, I'm not going to do anything. And so a rule of four ascending. Now, to create reflection and deep emotion, which you see in my speech repeatedly, taking the audience into deep emotion and then releasing them through humor. Tension, release. I call that a perambulation. It's like tightening the spring. Have you ever tightened a spring? You tighten it, tighten it, tighten it, then you can't tighten it anymore. And what happens when you let go? Boing! Right? Well, one of the problems that speakers have when you're talking about emotional concepts, you know, those heartbreaking concepts like you were talking about, Annette, you can take them into a deep place and they many times will resent it initially, will hold off on it. You know, because people resist speakers if they think you're just taking them to emotional place to be taking them to emotional place, right? My car broke down, my girlfriend left me, my dog died. Oh, shut up. You know, you're depressing me. But as speakers, we can take them to emotional places, but to gain their confidence, we have to release them from there too. And it's an interesting dynamic. When you begin speaking to an audience, they will resist you taking them to an emotional place. But if you take them in a little ways and then you release them with laughter, the next time you try to take them into an emotional place, they'll let you go deeper. Because they trusted the last time they released me, they'll release me this time. When I was preparing for the World Championship, I gave it to 30 different clubs, had it videoed. I gave the speech about 300 times before I actually competed. I got feedback that said, "You'll never win with that speech because nobody ever dies in a World Championship speech." Right? "And don't talk about cancer. Oh man, nobody wins with cancer in their speech." Right? Well, both my parents died in the speech, and my mom died of cancer. And they both died in the speech, and I still won. Why?
The speech was not about that. It was about love.
Right. And I never told you they died.
Well, how you told us was not manipulating us.
Right. How did I tell you my mom died?
When her sunrise.
Sunset fell and turned to starlight.
Yeah.
It's a metaphor.
Yeah.
Now, think about this. Why did I use a metaphor to tell you my mom died?
You can lighten up.
What?
You can lighten up the impact that this suppose my mother died. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If I say my mother died, it's a slap in the face. If I say her sunset fell and turned to starlight, it's a metaphor And in order to understand that metaphor, you have to go into your mind and process it in a way that's meaningful for you, right?
And besides, nobody ever dies in a championship.
That's right. That's right. So by giving you a metaphor to express it, it allows you to process it in a way that's not offensive to you. Right?
And it sounded like you had come to terms with it.
Right. I thought it through, and I was in a good place, is
and
what it said.
It made me think she was a beautiful woman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. See what's happening with the use of that metaphor? Mm-hmm. If I said she died, everybody would go, oh, that's too bad. You know? So when you're dealing with very prickly emotional feelings with an audience, use metaphors so that you can actually sneak it up on them and let them deal with it in a way that's useful to them. That power of perambulations is very powerful. And what you'll notice in lessons from Fat Dad, about four or five perambulations, and each time they get longer. In the very last perambulation, when I say, you know, this is my first Father's Day without Fat Dad, and I miss him, you hear my voice actually crack. Now, I had given that speech over 300 times, and one of the feedback I got regularly the last 40 or 50 times is, man, these are really serious topics. You don't have any emotion when you're talking about it. And I said, well, I'm saving that for the championship. And when I delivered that line, this is my first Father's Day without Fat Dad, and I miss him. In my mind, I went back to that afternoon when I kneeled down where he was crushed under the tractor and brushed the hair out of his eyes. You see, even when I go there right now, it has an effect on me. In my mind, that's where I was when I said, this is my first Father's Day without Fat Dad, and I miss him. And I almost fell completely apart. But that's what we were talking about earlier, about being real, being who you are. Letting that alabaster box be broken and release that humanity in you so that you can touch an audience. It's very powerful. On that last perambulation, I took them down for a minute and a half. And I held them down until that very last line, my children call me Fat Dad. The audience laughed and applauded, and it was done. So we're going to watch the speech again. Yes, Nate, one more question.
I think you had one. Talk a lot about humor and the whole thing you had about the emotional release and the tension.
Right.
It's sometimes you use the twist a lot to kind of get that laugh line.
Right.
Sometimes it would just be right after. You follow the rule of three or you ascend. You had a combination overall. Would you recommend combinations? Does one work better than another?
Well, it has to fit with the scenario. So you'll see... Fat Dad said, boys, real men love for a lifetime, not for a moment. Ruined the whole conversation! Well, that wasn't really a punchline, was it? But it was a release. And everybody laughed or went down faster than a spoonful of sugar. Well, why did that? There wasn't a funny line. Because everybody knows Mary Poppins, and a spoonful of sugar helps some medicine, go down. I kind of wonder why I didn't get challenged because I didn't say, and Mary Poppins said a spoonful of sugar. Kaleem.
I'm not here and I'm not familiar with that song of Mary Poppins, but I still found the spoonful of sugar really funny because
yeah.
The way it was phrased.
Yeah, it's a great, great line. Yeah, thank you. Was there another question over here? All right. So as we go through it, as you watch the speech this time, look for rules of three. Before we do that, I forgot to talk to you about descending rule of four. I didn't tell you about that, did I?
No.
Okay, well, this is important. Descending rule of four, same line. We cannot consecrate. We cannot dedicate. We cannot hallow this ground. Okay? Notice the difference? By slowing down the delivery, increasing the pausing, I can emote, I can cause the audience to emote. She stood on a high ledge. In an instant, she slipped. She fell. She plummeted. she was gone. Okay? You feel the electricity that happens when you slow that rate down and pausing and delivering and being comfortable with pausing. Did you have a question? Somebody raised their hand. Oh, it was you. Sorry. You were just...
Move by rate.
Ah, okay. Okay. All right.
She just bought the bowl.
Let's listen for simile, like or as, contrast, fat, skinny, short, tall, rhyme, echo, alliteration, metaphor, and watch for perambulation.
When I was 7, we drove to my cousin's for dinner and to show off Fat Dad's new car, a 1960 Ford Fairlane. I fell asleep in the back seat, and my folks left me sleeping as they went on up to the house. When I woke up, I stumbled out of the car and headed for the porch. I was surrounded by a pack of black and tan hunting hounds. My heart jumped, and then so did I, first to the trunk and then to the roof of his new car. Mr. Contest Chair, fellow Toastmasters and guests, I was frozen like a treed raccoon. I was bawling and screaming. The hounds were circling and howling. An ugly one-eyed dog clawed and scratched its way onto the trunk, its yellow teeth snapping and foaming. I was standing in water. It was mine. His claws screeched and slipped on the glass when I heard, "Son," and I dove at the voice to be caught in Fat Dad's arms. Safety was a flannel shirt that smelled of cherry tobacco and a thunderous bellow that scattered hounds like cottonseed on the wind. The next morning, Fat Dad was buffing the scratches out of his new car. I said, "Fat Dad, I'm sorry you had to rescue me." He scooped me up in his big arms, said, "Son, in life, sometimes you're the catcher, sometimes you're the caught. When you love somebody, their trouble is your trouble." Fat Dad was my daddy. And that loving nickname, Fat Dad, has been handed down through 4 generations to the men in my family. When I was 16, Fat Dad bought me a 1963 Volkswagen Beetle. Wide tires, chrome wheels. I was driving it one sunny afternoon, listening to Simon and Garfunkel on the 8-track. "Cecilia, you're breaking my heart." Humongous horsefly shot through the window, in my mouth, and down my throat. It came back up, lodged in my right nostril. What would you do with a horsefly buzzing in your nose, taking bites the size of Texas? I steered with my knees, tried to fire that bug out of my nose. The car shot to the left, then it catapulted back to the right. Chopped down Morrison's fence, sailing across their yard, right at Mossberger's fountain, where Mary Poppins stood, holding her umbrella, pouring water from a can. I hit that fountain so hard, I launched it like Sputnik. Mary Poppins hovered briefly, then went down faster than a spoonful of sugar. Well, the Morrisons and the Mossbergers, they were a bit excited. Not Fat Dad. He rode in like the cavalry, made peace with the neighbors. I sat on a rock in shock. As Fat Dad put his arm around me, I burst into tears. "We can fix the fence. I'll buy another fountain. We can even replace that old car. Those are just things but I could never replace you. Besides, the town will be talking about this for weeks. The lesson? Love. Now, teenage boys, they don't always think about cars. Sometimes they think about girls. Fat Dad overheard me and my buddies bragging about our adventures with women. Not being the shy type, he joined right in. Listen for a while, and then, like ice water thrown on you in a cold shower, said, "Boys, real men love for a lifetime, not for a moment." Ruined the whole conversation. But Fat Dad loved my mama when they walked in the garden or when they sat on the sofa. Their hands always seemed to find each other. And when Mama was sitting watching TV, Fat Dad would come up behind her, wrap his strong arms around her, rest his chin on her shoulder, kiss her on the cheek. Oh, as a teenager, I couldn't believe old people carried on that way. But Fat Dad's love was more than romance. When my mama battled the cancer that eventually took her life, Fat Dad, like a good shepherd, caring for a wounded lamb, fed and bathed, read and sang to her. And when my mama's sunset fell and turned to starlight, Fat Dad held her close, whispered words of love and faith to calm her fear. Fat Dad's love for my mama was a gift to my wife and children, because watching him, I learned to love them for a lifetime. This year I had my first Father's Day without Fat Dad. And I miss him. But the lessons he taught me will last a lifetime. When you love, sometimes you're the catcher. Sometimes you're the caught. When there's trouble, love rushes in, wraps its strong arms around you. Real men, well, they love for a lifetime. Not for a moment. Fellow Toastmasters, the lesson is love. And I'm proud to tell you, my children call me Fat Dad.
All right, Mr.